All right, so I'm Kevin Skadron. I cover the 1230 lecture. You've probably encountered me online, if not in person. Professor Rice is out of town with the ICPC programming team. He's actually in Kazakhstan right now. And so he may not be able, he runs the website, so he may not be able to upload the video and the slides. So if you want to refer to the video and the video will be in Panopto, and the slides will be in the files part of Canvas. And I'll post on Piazza to let people know that too. So in the 1230 section, there were a lot of questions about the quiz that you just finished. So I thought it would be good to start off by just reviewing the quiz. And I didn't realize how small this screen is and how long and deep this room is. So if you can't read that up there, I sincerely apologize. You are all welcome to get up and move closer. But question one and two both had the same setup. Oh, by the way, sorry for the interruption, but every mic is different. Every room is different. Can you all hear me okay in the back? Okay, too loud? I don't want to blast your eardrums. Okay. So we have this scenario, and the question asked, for which of these steps does an OS exception handler run that's not in association with a system call? So remember, exception is a big category. We have syscalls and other kinds of traps. We have faults, like divide by zero and page faults, and seg faults. And then we have external interrupts. And any kind of exception handler except something associated with a system call. Which steps invoke a handler? And it's just step one. And the reason is that in step one, hitting the keyboard invokes an I/O interrupt that invokes the OS. Now, the OS is going to recognize that the keyboard input that is in the buffer that it reads from the keyboard happens to have these magic characters, control C. But any keyboard input will trigger an interrupt. And so for an interrupt, we have to run a handler. But none of these other steps invoke an exception other than a system call. And we'll get to the system call part in question two. But any questions about this? Yes?
So in five, it's switching from process B to process A. Mm-hmm. So that's a context switch, right? So at some point, kernel code has to be run. And is that not an exception?
So this is a question that a lot of people had. Sorry, I forgot to put on my glasses. Steamy. Hopeless. When we get to step five, we're already in the kernel. And so the kernel, once it's invoked, will almost always make a scheduling decision about what process to run next. But we got into the kernel with a system call from the read here. So this and this are system calls invoking write and read respectively. And when we get to part five, we can do the context switch without having to invoke any other types of exceptions. Now you might be thinking, and I mean you collectively, you might be thinking, oh, but we learned about context switches in response to timer interrupts. And that is one way to get into the kernel. But we don't need a timer interrupt in this particular case. We're already in the kernel thanks to the system call. Other questions? Yes?
Part of that system calls handler if I think, does that trigger a page fault when the file, when when the file's data is not yet available, or is growing misunderstanding us?
So when you do a read from a process, the system call is invoked, and the system call handler will take your arguments and make sure they're okay, and then make sure that you actually have that file open. And then assuming everything's okay, it will create a buffer in kernel memory that is going to receive the data from the disk. So it allocates some memory from pages that are from frames of physical memory that are currently unused, and then it'll pass the address of that along with some other commands that are sent to the I/O device, whatever that I/O device is. And the I/O device is then set up to do something called direct memory access, where it can read the data, write it to the physical memory that the kernel set aside in the background while the CPU is doing other work, probably for another process. So there don't need to be any page faults or other exceptions here, because the kernel is setting up the memory, and the kernel can do that without any kind of page faults or any other exceptions. And then providing the address of that kernel buffer to the disk to send the data to. And so the disk will say, okay, I'm gonna go fetch these blocks of data from my disk, and I'm gonna put them on the bus with the destination of that memory address that the kernel gave me. And this all happens in the background, and unless the kernel has a bug, that memory should already be available. So does that answer your question?
Yes. Thank
Great.
You.
Other questions about this? Yes.
Can we ever have exceptions like while working in kernel?
So the question was, for benefit of the recording, can we have exceptions when we're in the kernel? And the question is, the answer is absolutely yes. We could take an I/O interrupt in particular, or some other kind of interrupt, indicating that something exceptional has happened in the outside world. Those could arrive at any point in time. Now, there are two ways that the kernel handles this. One is that where possible, it will be structured so that it can handle the new interrupt and finish that and then resume what it was doing. But it also has the ability to block most interrupts for a short period of time to make sure that it can finish some critical code without getting mixed up. And then it'll unblock the interrupts and see if any interrupts have arrived in the meantime. Yes, question.
Yeah, in step three, when the system restores the previously running function, does it need to go back into kernel mode to do that?
It does. So step three is going to set up something on the call stack for the process that's running the signal handler, so that when the signal handler returns, it basically executes a special kind of system call to get back into the kernel. So you're absolutely right that in step three, we need to transition back into the kernel.
And that would be with some kind of system call?
Effectively, yeah. Any other questions on this? Okay, so let's move on to question two, which we kind of already covered, which is where are there system calls in the sequence? You'll notice we left out step three, pertaining to your question, as one of the possible answers here, because we didn't really talk about how signal handler return works, and we didn't want to create confusion here, so we left step three out as an option. But yes, there is a return to kernel mode in step three. But out of the remaining options, I already said we have a write here and a read here. Those are two system calls, and apologies for my terrible handwriting. But we don't have system calls elsewhere in step one or step five. Yes?
How do you know if a function is going to make
So if you're looking at an example like this, you have to reason about what's going on underneath the covers. So for example, anytime we access an I/O device, whether it's a keyboard or disk or network, from a user level process, we have to be making a system call to read or write from that device. And so that's one level of answer to your question. Maybe that answered the question you had. If we're doing some kind of compiler analysis or some other kind of program analysis for software engineering techniques to make sure that the code is doing what we expect, the program analysis will have access to the assembly language instructions and be able to say, oh, there's a syscall there. Any other questions? Yeah.
Would reading like input from the keyboard usually require a system call?
Reading from any I/O device will require a system call, yes. And so the reason that we want the OS involved between the process and the keyboard is to make sure that only the process that's entitled to read from the keyboard can do so. And it can't like grab user input that wasn't intended for that process. So control C is special. So the question was why isn't step one involving a read system call? And it's because control C is meant to be this asynchronous way that when you type control C at the keyboard, unless the user has registered a signal handler for that, the process will just get killed. And it'll never see that there was any input. And even if there's a signal handler registered for SIGINT, the process won't find out about the SIGINT through a read, it'll find out about it through the signal. And so, not to put too fine a point on it, but this gets at the distinction between exceptions and signals. When the control C happens, that raises an interrupt, which invokes an interrupt handler in the kernel for any keyboard input. Now the kernel is going to, in that interrupt handler, it's going to look at the keyboard input and see that there is a control C there and go, oh, this is a special case. That is going to generate a signal for the process that's currently connected to the keyboard. Now let me go see if that process has a signal handler registered. If not, I'll just terminate the process. If so, I'll invoke the signal handler. So signal handlers are not exceptions, but like interrupts, signal handlers can happen kind of at any point in time or be invoked at any point in time to handle asynchronous events. So a signal is a way for either a user level process using kill, to notify some other process asynchronously about something, and that signal will eventually get delivered unless it's blocked, and also for the OS to notify a user-level process that something special has happened, like a SIGINT or a divide by zero or whatever the process has registered a signal handler for. So exceptions cause the kernel to run a handler in kernel mode. Signals cause a user-level process to run a signal handler, if registered, in user mode. So questions 3, 4, and 5 refer to this scenario. So X is running on the CPU, Y is waiting for keyboard input, and Z at some previous point in time got context switched off the CPU and is running, is suspended. So what we're trying to get at here is where the state of these programs resides at different points in time. at different points in this life cycle of running on the CPU, being suspended, et cetera. So if you're running on the CPU, your registers need to be in the actual physical hardware registers of the CPU. So for question three, the answer is that the value of the general purpose register RAX for process X, that value is actually in the hardware register on the CPU. And for process Z, which was suspended, it's not running on the CPU. So when it got suspended, what the kernel did was copy its state, including the register files, off the CPU and store them in memory. And then it took the context of whatever process was running, let me back up, getting my tongue twisted. So it copied the state of Z into memory, took it off the CPU. Now it's going to run X. So it takes the state of X and puts that state back into the CPU. So context switching allows a process to get put in suspended animation. And it's not on the CPU. It's just like frozen, like when somebody is put in cryo sleep in a sci-fi film. It's just frozen. And when it wakes up, it doesn't know how much time has passed unless it checks the clock. It just wakes up and picks up exactly where it left off. And a process can go through many cycles of being suspended and then reawakened and put on the CPU. So any questions about this before I go to the next slide? Yes? So when we talk about a context switch, we mean that we're taking the state of a process that's on the CPU and storing it into memory, so that process is now suspended and we can resume it later. And we're taking some other process and putting it on the CPU. And actually, the process that we're putting onto the CPU could be a process that was previously suspended or was just freshly created, like with fork. But we're swapping which processes are running. And that context switch can be invoked in several ways. So one way that we talked about in the last class, I believe, is timer interrupts. And so we use timer interrupts to be able to preempt a program that is hogging the CPU. It might be hogging the CPU because it's in an infinite loop. It might just be doing a really extensive computation that involves no system calls, like computing the bazillionth prime number. And we don't want it to tie up the CPU for an arbitrary amount of time, so we set the OS sets a timer for like a millisecond, and when that hardware timer raises an interrupt, that invokes the OS timer interrupt exception handler, which can then do a context switch. Another way is that we get into the OS by making a system call. After any system call, or as part of any system call, we get into the OS, and the OS can now make a scheduling decision. And it might choose to keep the current process running, or it might make a context switch. The third way is that a process can explicitly yield the CPU by doing something like pause, which you'll remember basically says, I want to go to sleep until a signal that I'm interested in is raised. And there's other kinds of system calls like that that basically allow the process to say, I don't have anything more useful to do, so wake me up when there's something of interest. Or wake me up, like with sleep, wake me up after X milliseconds. So when we talk about a context switch, it can be sort of triggered by any of those mechanisms. So now going on to what's happening with question five here. So suppose, so question one, process Y was waiting for keyboard input. So suppose now the user hits something on the keyboard, and let's assume it's not Control C. So now that's going to raise an interrupt. The OS will get invoked. The OS will make note of the fact that there is now input for process Y, and it'll make a scheduling decision. It can choose to just buffer that input if it's not Control C. It can choose to just buffer that input and go do something else. Resume the process that had been on the CPU or run another process, whatever. And eventually Y will run and see the input. Or it can immediately context switch to Y. No matter what, the keyboard is activity is going to invoke the kernel through an interrupt handler. And in this particular case where we say that Y resumes running, we have to do a context switch, which means we have to take the state of X off of the CPU and move all of its register values, including the stack pointer, to memory, and take the values, the state of Y that had been suspended, and put that onto the CPU, including all of its registers. By the way, I should clarify, I don't know if Professor Rice talked about this, but when we talk about taking the state of a process off the CPU and putting it in memory, the kernel has a data structure. It's basically an array of what's called process control blocks that have information about each process. And so it copies the register values into the corresponding fields of the process control block when it's taking a process off the CPU. And then later, when the scheduler says, let's run process Y, we go to the process control block for process Y. The register values that we previously saved are there. Copy them back to the CPU. So any questions on this? Okay, question six, sorry for the small font. We have two processes that are running identical copies of the same program. And in each of those processes, we've registered these two signal handlers. And then some assumptions at the bottom that say, you know, nothing special happens. And so to actually get to the question, I just put the signal handlers up there at the top so that you can refer to them. And the question was, if SIG user 2 signal is sent to PID 2001, which of the following are possible outcomes? So a simple scenario here is that, this is going to invoke this, right? And so it's always going to first print B. If the problem stated, you know, there's nothing else going on in the background, so we're not going to invoke signal handler for SIG user 1. So we can't have A appear on the screen before B. So that rules this out. So it has to be one of these three green scenarios where we start with B. And we can talk about the last one in, a little later. So now that signal handler prints B, and then it raises this signal to PID 1000. So we go up here, and we're eventually going to run this signal handler. Now remember, when you raise a signal for your own process, the signal handler runs immediately. But when you raise a signal to another process, that signal could be delivered to the other process at an arbitrary point in time in the future. Because we've invoked kill, which is a syscall, the operating system makes a scheduling decision. It may decide it's not going to run PID 1000 right now, but it'll remember that this signal is pending. So one possible scenario is that it does indeed run the signal handler, and we print A, and then PID 2001 gets terminated, and we're done. That's a simple kind of version of this. Another scenario, which I'll use a different color for, is that we print B, and then we invoke the signal handler, and the OS remembers the signal, but decides to resume B, decides to resume PID 2001, and so we PID 2001 writes C, and then at some later point in time, the signal handler is delivered to PID 1000, and then we print A, and then kill PID 2001. So in the first scenario, when PID 2001 signal handler for user SIG user 2 is running, and it raises that signal to PID 1000, we go ahead and handle that signal. The OS delivers that signal right away and invokes that signal handler, and the signal handler runs to completion. So that's the first bullet. The second bullet is that the kernel only remembers the signal but resumes PID 2001, finishes that signal handler, and then later runs the signal handler for PID 1000. And then the final scenario is that we invoke the signal handler here for PID 1000. So we print B, then we print A, then we take some kind of exception that invokes the OS. Maybe it's a timer interrupt. Maybe it's some other kind of exception. And the OS decides to run PID 2001 again before we get to this kill. So we've printed A, but we haven't yet invoked the kill. And now the OS scheduler decides, oh, I'm going to resume PID 2001. So now it can print C, and then PID 2001 returns from the signal handler and does whatever it's going to do, and then PID 2001 gets finally killed up here. So what we're trying to get at is this possibility that different interleavings can happen. Context switching can happen a lot of ways. So when you have two different processes or threads that are interacting, you should never make assumptions about what the interleaving of activity is. In theory, you can take a context switch between any two assembly language instructions arbitrarily. And so for coordinating, this is hard to reason about. And in particular, if you need a particular sequence of events, you need a way to coordinate. And most importantly, if you have two threads in the same process that are cooperating on a shared data structure, you need to control when the two threads that are sharing this data structure run so that they don't accidentally corrupt the data structure. And so later in the semester, we'll look at how to write programs with proper synchronization using things like signals or condition variables. Sorry, not signals. Using, confusingly, some synchronization mechanisms use the term signal in a completely different way. But we'll find that out later. But what I meant to say is using semaphores or condition variables. And that way you can make sure that, for example, if there's a producer-consumer relationship, that the producer has finished committing, you know, all of the output that the consumer should see, despite arbitrary context switching that might be happening. And so these synchronization primitives are a way for a program to tell the operating system, I don't want to run until this other process has said it's ready for me to run. So this arbitrary context switching makes things quite tricky, but it's an important thing to be aware of. So any questions about this? Yes.
Wouldn't it be possible that the SIG action for PID 1000 is no longer registered if that program ends, and so the kill for PID 2000 would go through and then the program would just end?
You're asking about this one, right? The last option? So yes, absolutely. And we looked at an example in class where one process raises a signal to another process, and but the other process has either not yet registered its signal handler, so the signal is lost, or the other process is exited, so there's no signal handler, I mean, that process just doesn't exist. And I'm gonna be legalistic here and say, no other code in the program will cause the program to exit, which we intended to rule out this last option here. But you're absolutely right that that scenario is something you have to reason about. We just kind of legalistically tried to exclude it.
Okay. Where does it say that you know that it's been registered in the question? Were we supposed to, when it says like, it says that the signals are sent off, are we supposed to assume that means they're registered?
Let me look back here at the text. So two answers to that. One is kind of this legalistic answer. We said is set up. So by that we meant to say that it's already been registered. But I guess another way of thinking about this, if you're thinking about which of these answers is correct, is we said which of the following are possible outcomes. So there may be other possible outcomes that we didn't list at all. But certainly these three are possible. Option 4 is impossible, and option 5 we excluded with this language down here. So that covers the quiz. Any other questions?
So when you're sending the kill signal, like just outright kill, not like sending signals or one, just in general, like sending kills in the process, could that also get delayed, like another sending code, or just outright kill is always getting
like? So I believe, so the question was about delivering an actual kill, so signal number 9, which cannot be caught. So I believe signals are delivered in order. So if 2 signals are sent to a process, they'll be delivered to that process in order. So if there's a signal that's currently pending and now a kill comes along, I believe, I actually can't swear to this, we'd have to go back and look at the spec, that this signal 9 won't be delivered until the previous signal has been handled. But I mean, that would be governed by the spec. Did that answer your question?
I think I was more so asking, like, when you send, like, the, for example, like, send the kill, does it get, like, run immediately, or could it also be, like, delayed?
I see. So you mean it, when you say, when you execute the kill system call, if you're raising a signal for your own process, it'll be delivered immediately. If you're raising a signal to another process, it may be delivered immediately, but it may be delivered at an arbitrary point in the future.
Does that also apply to
yes. Okay. So if I said, if here I said SIG kill 2001, well, yeah. So like in this, when I deliver SIG kill, it doesn't necessarily happen right away. Sorry, I misunderstood the question initially.
I actually had a question about number 5. So, is the only exception an interrupt?
Yes.
Okay.
The question was, is the only exception in this problem the interrupt associated with the key press? And the answer is yes. I'm saying that for the recording. Other questions? Okay. So let's move on to the lecture material. Let me pull that up. So okay, so so we covered the quiz review. In your lab tomorrow, you're going to be doing some work with signals. That's kind of a variation on what we've shown here already. And so I want to review some signal material a little bit to make sure that you're productive in the lab. And then we'll pick up where we left off with fork and move on to exec, and if time permits, weight PID. In the last class, we only got through exec, so we didn't even get to this other stuff. So last time, we talked about signals and then fork. Signals, I already told you, these are the two forms of a signal. They're a way to notify a user-level process that something happened, and the handler, if one is registered, runs in that process that is receiving the signal. Signals have default actions, mostly terminate. There are exceptions, like sigstop. A process can register a signal handler for most signals that will be run when the signal is delivered. And there are a couple of exceptions, like sigkill and sigstop, that cannot be caught. So the default action is the action. You can block signals for an arbitrary amount of time. And then you can, there are various ways to find out when a signal that you blocked on actually happens. And you'll use that, I think, in the lab. And then we talked just a minute ago in the answer to a question about when signals are delivered. And last class, we also talked a little bit about signal safety and why you might need to block signals so that things don't get corrupted. And then we started discussing fork. And when I say star NICs, you'll see this terminology in the literature sometimes. That's a way of referring to the family of Unix and Linux, which are all kind of sharing a common heritage. So if we go all way back to sort of early in the last class period, we looked at this example for handling a segfault, for handling any signal, really. So we're going to write a function that is the signal handler. Then we're going to, somewhere in the program, like in main, but it doesn't have to be, wherever is the appropriate point for the program logic, we're going to create a variable that is of type struct sig action. And this struct has various fields. You can look it up in the man page for signals. One important one is a function pointer to the handler that you're registering. So we just give the name of the function that we want to be the handler, and that's a function pointer. Then we empty this mask to indicate that, you know, all other signals are not being addressed by here. We're only registering this signal handler for this particular signal. And so then the sig action is what actually registers the signal handler. This act variable contains all the information about what, how we want this signal to be handled. This is the signal that we're handling, and some other options that we're not going to use here. The SA restart here just says that we want the operation that was being done when the signal got invoked to be resumed after the signal handler returns. And then in this sample program, we do something that is almost guaranteed to cause an illegal access and raise a segfault, which is write to some arbitrary address that most likely hasn't been allocated. And so that will, that's a fault, a segfault, writing to an illegal address, which will invoke an exception handler for that particular type of fault. The OS, when it recognizes that this is a seg fault, will say, oh, for seg faults, I always deliver a signal to the offending program in case it wants to do something. And then it checks the signal state for that process that caused the seg fault and determines whether there's a signal handler registered. If there's no signal handler registered, then it does the default action, and for seg fault, as you, I'm sure we've all experienced many times, it's to terminate the process. But if there is a handler registered, it'll run the handler. And so this particular program will produce this output, which will repeat over and over and over again, because when the signal handler returns, it resumes what it was trying to do before, and it repeats this illegal access over and over and over. So everybody comfortable with what's going on here? So this is a common way to register a signal handler, and an example that is actually using it and happens to be triggering the signal in the same code. So some common APIs that you need to be comfortable with are SIGACTION, which registers a handler, KILL, which sends a signal to any process. You can use it to send any signal. It's kind of an anachronism that this system call is called KILL instead of like raise signal. Pause will put a process to sleep until a signal is received by that process. So that's one way to wait for a signal. And if you've registered a signal handler, then when that signal is raised, your signal handler will run. SIGPROCMASK is a way to specify some set of signals that you want to block. And that signal will be pending. The OS will remember that that signal needs to be delivered. It doesn't just disappear if you've blocked it. We talked about this in the last class. We've already talked about the fact that signal delivery is asynchronous if you're delivering a signal to another process. And then we looked at a couple of examples in the last class. So in this example, the correct answer was E, because we know that X is going to be printed because these processes are running, and this is the signal that gets sent, which is going to invoke a signal on itself and print X, and then try to raise a signal to PID 2000. And if PID 2000 has already registered its signal handler, then it will run this signal handler and print Y. But maybe this process hasn't registered the signal handler yet, because the signal could be delivered at an arbitrary point in time in the future. Or maybe this process already ran and exited, and there's no process left to deliver a signal to, which is why the answer here is E. So to fix that, we added this code. Now, PID 2000 does pause, which says, I'm just going to hang around until a signal is delivered. And we're relying on the signal handler having been registered here. And the sleep is a hacky way to try to get PID 1000 to wait long enough to give PID 2000 a chance to register its signal handler. Can't be guaranteed that that 1 second sleep is actually long enough, but 1 second's an eternity in CPU land when, you know, clock speed is a gigahertz or more. So it's probably good enough, but, you know, we're doing this hacky thing just to avoid writing some more elaborate code that would take up too much time to explain. So now we're guaranteed that A will be the behavior, because this will print X, this will run this handler, which will print Y, then PID 1000 will exit, and then, PID 2000 will exit, and PID 1000 will exit. There could be some interleaving here. It could be that when PID 1000 raises the signal over there on the left, that PID 2000 doesn't run right away, and PID 1000 returns from kill and exits, and only later is the signal delivered to PID 2000. But assuming that the sleep one is long enough, we're guaranteed that X will get printed and Y will get printed. In the last class, somebody astute, at least in our section, pointed out that this code never runs. And that was just kind of a mindless cut and paste to make the two look symmetric. But unless the kill fails for some reason and returns an error code, that line I marked with blue will never run. And if we do get to that line, PID 1000 is going to be in an infinite loop, or not really an infinite loop. It's going to be paused forever unless something else causes a signal to be delivered. Like maybe somebody notices it's been running forever and sends it a sig kill. Any questions about this? So then we talked about some issues that can happen due to the way that signals can affect the state of a process. And so in this particular example, we have some function that's doing a malloc. And in the example, malloc gets interrupted by a signal, and the signal handler does a printf. And so here we see a little more detail. The malloc so if we're in malloc, when we receive the signal, it can potentially corrupt the state of malloc so that the pointer we return here is an illegal pointer. And the issue is that this printf also does malloc. So inside the printf to hold the string that you're providing, it's doing a malloc. And so that leads to the sequence of events where because of the signal, we give the wrong value for to return. And so after the sequence of events, malloc's returning the wrong pointer. And here's a little more detail, but in the interest of time, I just want to say that for most functions, you need to contemplate the possibility that a signal handler could be invoked, and depending on what the signal handler is doing, might corrupt the state of the code that you're writing. And so this isn't going to happen with arbitrary code. It's only if the signal handler is touching the same thing that got interrupted. So in this example, our user-level code foo was using malloc. But our signal handler is also using malloc. And that's what can lead to this corruption. And so the solution is to block signals in critical code like malloc. So when you invoke malloc, you should block signals. And then when malloc completes, it should unblock signals. And that way, we don't have to worry about this kind of corruption. There are several ways to block signals. Sigprocmask is the common one. If you have a multi-threaded program and you only want to block signals for one of the threads, then you would use pthread sigmask. When a signal is blocked, it stays pending. And then there are various ways to find out about pending signals. So here's an example timeline where a signal is raised, it's blocked and pending until we either unblock the signal or we run some other function that lets us find out about that pending signal. And there are various ways that you can do this. Sig wait, I think, is the most useful, and that's what you might want to use in your lab. And here's an example of using sig wait. So here I'm blocking sigint. So I get an empty mask. I make sure it's empty. Then I set the bit in the mask for sigint. And then I say sigprocmask with the argument sigblock. There are other things that you can say. With this set that I've just populated to say, I want to block sigint. Only sigint. I'm not changing any other signals. I'm not blocking any other signals. If I did want to block other signals, I would have additional calls to sigaddset. So I could say sigaddset sigint, and then sigaddset siguser1, and sigaddset siguser2, and on and on and on for all the signals I want to block. And then when I say sigpocmask sigblock with this set that I've populated, all the signals that I sigaddset to the mask will be blocked. Now I can sigwait on this set of blocked signals. And this will be filled in by the kernel with the delivered signal number. So SIGWAIT will suspend this process until one of the blocked signals is raised, and then SIGWAIT will return, NUM will be filled in with the number of the signal that was actually raised, and we go on our merry way, and now we know the signal was delivered. So if you're waiting for a signal and you want to just hang out until a certain signal is delivered, like in the lab, you might be waiting for SIGUser 1 or SIGUser 2 to be delivered. You don't actually need to write a signal handler if you're not doing anything special. If all you're doing is waiting for the existence of this raised signal, SIGWAIT is sufficient. So there are different ways that you can handle signals. Sometimes they're equally correct. If all you're doing is waiting for a signal, SIGWAIT is the easiest way to do it, because you don't have to worry about the semantics of exactly how signal handlers behave and so on and so forth. So in this example, we know that NUM is going to be SIGINT, but if I had blocked several signals, NUM could be any one of those signals, and I need to actually look at NUM to find out what the specific signal was. So maybe I want to do different actions. So I might say, if NUM is SIGINT, print something. If NUM is SIGUser 1, do something else. If NUM is SIGUser 2, do something else that's different than those other actions. Everybody good on this? Okay, so let's change gears and talk about fork and exec. So, brief review of fork. Fork is a way for a process to create another process. There are reasons why you might want to create copies of the same process and have them all running. It's one way to do parallel processing. It's one way to create a bunch of different handlers for certain kind of events. But the common paradigm, and the one that you see happening in a command line shell, is that the fork is going to be followed by an exec, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But for now, for all these purposes, fork just creates a copy. It is a perfect copy of the process, except that they will, of course, have different PIDs. They get their own copies of memory, and they, unless you change something, they will have the same file descriptors. And although they are separate processes, they will have the same copies of the register values. So we've got a process here, it calls fork, it allocates some memory and makes a copy of the first process. It's a perfect copy, everything is the same, but then for the return value from the fork system call, the OS in the parent process will fill in the child PID as the return value for fork, and it will fill in 0 for the child process's return value. So when you return from fork, you can look at the return value of that system call, and if it's non-zero and positive, you know that you're the parent, and you also have access to the child's PID. If it's 0, you're the child, and you can get your own PID if you need it by calling getPID. And incidentally, you can get your parent's PID if you really want it by calling get PPID, parent PID. If the return value from fork is negative, as with many system calls, it means there was an error. So here's an example of using this in code. So the stuff at the top isn't that important, but you see here the fork call, and we capture the value, the return value, and if the return value is greater than 0, then we know we're in the parent. If it's 0, then we know we're in the child. Otherwise, we know that there was some error. And then we can do whatever logic is appropriate for the parent and for the child. So if it's a child and we're going to launch a new process, the next thing we might do is run exec. If it's the parent, the next thing we might do is print out another command prompt and wait for input. So we went through all this last time. This example will have this timeline, and this is an example of the output. The parent and child, it's important to note, could run in any order. So when the parent calls fork, the next, and the child is created, but then which one runs next on the CPU is arbitrary. The parent could be the next thing that runs, and the child's been created, but it hasn't run yet, or the child could be the next thing that runs. So to get at that, let's consider this question. And in the interest of time, I'll just sort of give away the answer here, but very simple example, fork. The parent is going to print in child. The parent is going to print the child and its PID. The child is going to print in child. And then regardless, they're going to print done. Right? So if you're in the child, you take this value, you do an if on it, you print this, then you leave that if statement and you're running this code in your child process. The parent runs the else clause and then leaves the if then else statement and runs that same line. So remember, these are perfect copies. When they return from fork, they both separate processes, but they both pick up running this program at the return from that function call. So here's a couple possible interleavings. There are other possibilities too. The parent could run and fork, and then the child could be the next thing that runs, and it prints child 100. Sorry, I'm getting my ordering mixed up here. We wanted the fork to be over here. So the parent, the first thing that returns could print this, child 100. Then we take a context switch. And then we're in the child, and the first thing we do is print in child. And then the child could go on and print done, or maybe the child takes an interrupt, and now the parent prints done. Various possible interleavings are possible. In another example, the parent doesn't get to print yet, and the first thing that gets to a printf is the child, and then the child goes on and prints done before the parent gets to run. So here's child, here's parent. So let's test our understanding with this question. So talk to your neighbors and decide which of these answers are possible. So we've got a fork, and the child is adding 1 and 2 to x, and x was initialized to 0. And the parent is adding 3 and 4 to x. So take a minute and talk to your neighbors. And then we'll take votes. Okay, so sorry to rush you a bit, but I do want to get through exec, so let's go ahead and vote. How many people think A is one of the possible answers? All right. How many people think B is possible? How many people think C is possible? How many people think D is a possible answer? Okay, E and F. All right, so the correct answers are A and D. So the important thing to remember here is that after the fork, the two processes are completely independent. The child is a copy of the parent, but once the fork is completed and that child is set up, it is a completely different process, completely separate memory. There's no sharing whatsoever. Now, they may share open files, and we'll get to that later. But so you can get weird stuff if they're both trying to output to a file. But we'll talk about that later. And with that exception, they're completely independent. So when the child is adding to X and Y here, it's starting with 0 no matter what. Because when the fork happened, X and Y were 0. And after the fork, the child has its own private copies of X and Y. And the parent, after the fork, it also had X and Y being 0 when the fork happened. And the parent is independent of the child. So when the parent is adding 3 and 4, it is adding them to values that started out as 0 and completely unaffected by what the child is doing. So both the parent and the child will print their values of X and Y. So the parent will print 3 and 4, and the child will print 1 and 2. We don't know what order the parent and child run in, which is why both A and D are options. Okay? So in the few minutes we have remaining, let's talk about exec. So what exec does is it replaces the current process with a new program. So it's the same sort of process container. But we're going to completely wipe out the previous process, again with the exception of open files, and replace it with the state of a new program. And there are many, many flavors of exec because people have decided they want to have different ways of setting up the new program, a simple one is execv. So we provide the path to the program that we're going to run. So /bin/ls. You can also use a relative path, and it'll rely on the existing path environment variable, if there is one. And then we have to set up argv. So when your main in a program you write is looking at argv, that argv string array was set up by exec. There are different ways to do it with different flavors of exec, but it's exec that's setting up argv by putting those things on the stack and filling them in with the correct strings. And argv of 0 is always the program name, and then all the other fields are the subsequent arguments, if there are any, and then the last thing in argv is always null. And then the exec function is smart enough to count how many items there are in argv so that it can populate argc. And then with other flavors, you can sort of do extra stuff. So here's an example of how we use it. Now in the child process, let's say we want to run ls minus l. In the child process, we fill in argv with these three strings. Ls is the program name, that's always argv of 0. Minus l is the only argument that we're passing beyond, it's the only actual argument to ls. And then null, because that's how we tell exec that that's the end of the argv. Then we actually run exec v with the path name and the argv that we've populated. And exec v will not return if it's successful. So inside exec, we actually set up the new program and start it running. So exec, if it's successful, turns this process into ls, and ls just starts running and goes into main and does all that stuff. So we only return from exec if exec fails. So if we return from exec, we need to check for an error. So if this were in a shell, what the parent would be doing now is probably printing out a new command prompt and waiting for the next command. Any questions on this? Yes?
So why in the arguments, why do we need an ls if that's the path for a program?
Just by convention, the C standard says that argv of 0 is always the program name. And that's so that the process, if it needs to, can find out how it was invoked. Now you'll notice there's a discrepancy here between the path I specified and what I put in argv of 0. Generally, that's not a good idea. But you could do that if you didn't want the program to know that it was invoked by slash bin slash ls. But generally, those should be the same. And so generally, what you do is you'd fill in argv with whatever, if you were writing a shell, you'd fill in argv 0 with whatever was actually the way that it was invoked. So if they typed slash bin slash ls, you'd also put that in argv of 0. If they just typed ls and relied on the path variable, then you would just put ls in argv of 0. This is just elaborating what I said before. So what's actually going on underneath the covers is that this is, let's say, the child here. We've got this copy that was made from the parent. This is the copy of the parent from fork. And maybe this has changed slightly because the child process went and did some extra stuff before calling exec. But it's the result of the fork. So maybe I should have said result of the parent fork. Okay, so the exec is now going to set up new pages in memory to hold the new stack, the new heap, the new data segment, and the new program segment for this new process that we're setting up. And it'll fill them in, it'll load the program segment with the contents of the executable file, it'll initialize the stack, it'll initialize any global data, and so on. It'll copy the arguments into the newly created program stack. Note that these here don't change, and we'll talk about that in the next class. And then the last thing we do is we get rid of the old memory of this process because we don't need the old stack and the old data segment and so on. We've created a new one. The reason we allocate new pages for this is just to simplify some things. Trying to muck around with an existing stack while we're running on the same stack would be kind of messy. So that's why it's easier just to allocate new pages, set up the new program state in fresh memory, and then deallocate the stuff from the old program that was running. Now, all this is happening in the same process container. So that's a good place to stop and take questions. Any questions about how exec works? So if you were writing a shell, you have most of what you need to write a shell. You could print a command prompt, read the command prompt, fork a child, exec what was the contents of that command prompt. The only thing that you're missing is how does the parent wait for the child to complete? And we'll get to that in the next class as well. All right, thanks everyone, and good luck on the lab tomorrow.